Welcome to today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available at recordinglibrary.org and on the telephone reader by calling 432-617-5555.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Monday, January 13th, 2020. Section A. DPS reports Midlander, one of two dead after accident east of city. A Midland man was one of two people who died Friday night after a crash east of Midland. Department of Public Safety officials reported that Juan J. Espinosa, 30, died after his Ford F-250 collided with a 1999 Cub Cadet truck tractor that was towing a semi-trailer. An investigation indicated that Espinosa's Ford was traveling north on FM 1208 around 6:50 p.m. However, the vehicle was traveling on the wrong side of the roadway, according to DPS, and collided with a truck tractor that was being driven by Javier Delgado, a 44-year-old man from Miami. Delgado also passed away at the scene. There has been one other fatality on roads inside Midland County this year, according to Reporter Telegram records. That happened January 5th on County Road 1232, 1 mile south of Midland. There were 26 deaths on roads inside Midland County in 2019, according to Reporter Telegram records. In 2018, there were 44. Criminal defense attorney runs for 142nd District Court Judge by Caitlin Randall. David Rogers, a Midland criminal defense attorney, has announced his candidacy for 142nd District Court Judge. The native Midlander has practiced criminal and family law for 25 years. He is currently a partner at Five Coat and Rogers. Rogers said in an interview he believes his experience as a criminal lawyer would serve him well on the 142nd District Court, which primarily oversees criminal cases. I thought as a board-certified criminal law specialist, it fit with what the court does, he said. Rogers is the sole candidate running for the 142nd District Court seat who is board certified in criminal law, he said, and one of three criminal attorneys in Midland to be certified by the Texas Board of Legal Specialization. He said in a press release he believes a record of accountability, transparency, and fairness are essential to presiding over the courtroom. I will ensure that anyone who enters the courtroom is treated equally and has confidence in an impartial justice system, he said in the release. But I will also be unafraid to issue tough sentences to the worst actors in Midland County who violate our laws and prey on the innocent. Rogers attended Midland High School and graduated from Texas A&M University with a degree in history. He attended law school at St. Mary's University in San Antonio before returning to Midland to practice at Brockett and Lindemood. He is one of three candidates vying for the Republican nomination for 142nd District Court Judge. Mary Baker, an oil and gas attorney, and Wayne Frost, who ran for 441st District Judge in 2018, previously announced their candidacies. The presiding judge of the 142nd District Court, George Jody Gillis, announced in September that he won't seek re-election after 27 years on the bench. His term will end January 2021. The Republican and Democratic primaries are March 3rd. The general election is November 3rd. Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Monday, January 13th, 2020, Section B. Dear Abby, man is reluctant to share memories of his late father. Dear Abby, My boyfriend of 2 years and I recently moved in together. When we first met, he let me know he had lost his father to cancer a few years prior. While I know a little about his father, it is mostly superficial. As our relationship has progressed, moving in, talking about our future, I long to know more about his dad. What kind of a father and husband was he? What special memories does my boyfriend have of spending time with him? However, when I ask questions, I get succinct answers with no elaboration. If I ask more than one question at a time, I feel like I'm pulling teeth, so I just drop it. When I asked if he's uncomfortable talking about it, he says it's fine, but I still know next to nothing. The only time he brings up his dad is around the time of his dad's birthday, the anniversary of his death, or the time when they found out about his prognosis. At those times, he is clearly grieving. I don't want to cause my boyfriend more pain, and I worry that I'm being insensitive by asking him to talk about it. Yet, if we are going to start a life together and be a family one day, I want to know about his father. Curious in New York. Dear Curious, your boyfriend may not want to discuss his relationship with his father because the subject is painful, either because of his death or because they were not close. If you want more details, you might have better luck asking your boyfriend's mother or his siblings, if he has any, because the subject clearly makes him uncomfortable. Back off. Dear Abby, I don't smoke, but my mother and fiancé are chain smokers. This is particularly annoying when the three of us eat together because they always light up during the meal. For example, they'll almost always have a cigarette after the salad, another before the dessert, and then two or three cigarettes afterward. It ruins the meal for me. I'm really disappointed in my fiancé, who seems to have forgotten her promise to quit smoking before our wedding day. Is there anything I can do about their smoking at the dinner table? And should I remind my fiancé about her promise to give up cigarettes and be a smoke-free bride? Annoyed in Alabama. Dear Annoyed, your mother and fiancé are nicotine addicts. That they cannot get through a meal without lighting at least three cigarettes is alarming. No rule of etiquette dictates that you must tolerate secondhand smoke while you are trying to enjoy your dinner. If they need a fix, they should be considerate enough to excuse themselves from the table to indulge. On a slightly different but equally important subject, your fiancé has not forgotten her promise to give up cigarettes before your wedding. She's ignoring it. And you haven't called her on it. Please do. If you marry her, you will be living in a tobacco haze for the rest of her life, which could have a negative effect on your and your children's health in the future. Don't say you weren't warned. Letters to the Editor. Norman has a vision for the future. I attended the candidate forum for City Council District 2 race on Tuesday. I was very impressed by John Norman. His approach to this City Council race was more about a vision for the future than it was about potholes. He had a flyer about economic opportunity zones that explained how he would work to encourage development in District 2, but it was his rationale that was most interesting. By encouraging business development in District 2, he said greater property valuations are added to the city's property tax base. Over the long term, adding to the tax base helps keep property taxes low for the entire city. This is a smart approach and long overdue. I am supporting John Norman for City Council District 2. Debbie Jones. Norman's leadership needed on council. John Norman has a gift. He has demonstrated his leadership abilities on the professional football field, in the classroom, and in business. Now he's offered himself to the community to be the next City Council representative for District 2. He's presented both a vision for future development of District 2 and for how he would stay connected to the residents of District 2. With his leadership, District 2 will be the winner. I encourage everyone to vote for John Norman for City Council District 2. Kara Miller. Norman will be good for Midland. After living in Midland from 1962 until 2019 and teaching in Midland ISD, I would like to share my information and feelings about the upcoming election. I taught a boy when he was in the ninth grade, 1993 to 94, through high school. I feel like I've known him through all kinds of life and school adventures. I've been able to see him live by the guidance of his father, who is a great daddy. John Norman was raised with great values and love for all. He always had a heart for helping young people grow to be good people and have good lives. Now I see him sharing his deep desire to help even adults have good, happy, and comfortable lives. He can really help make Midland a much better place to live. I would like to encourage every person to support John's run for the Midland City Council. I have no doubt that things will move to a more positive side and start to get better. Please support John Norman for the City Council in any way you can. He is really a good person and good for Midland. Carol Hall, Granbury. Norman has invested time and money in District 2. I am proud of John Norman. John Norman has invested both his time and money in District 2 over the years. His money has been spent expanding his business on Florida Avenue, and his time has been spent helping our kids become better athletes and better people. I think we can all be proud of the work he's done to make District 2 and the city of Midland a better place. I'd be proud to have John Norman serve on City Council for District 2. Antoine Alexander. Commentary. Norman is dedicated to community and wants opportunity for all Midlanders, by John B. Love III of the Midland City Council. I've been blessed to have held many leadership positions politically and have had the opportunity to understand what is required of those who serve. An elected official, especially on the municipal level, must be both a representative and a leader. They must be a representative because they must represent the people's will, and a leader because they must lead the people where they know not. The next city council member for the city of Midland must be both a representative and a leader. Yes, the representative must listen to what the people want, but the leader must do things that the people may need. As the District 2 City Councilman for the last 7 years, I believe it is imperative that the new council member be both. The reality is that the average citizen does not have and will not have all the information that a city council member will receive. I know this from personal experience. I have cast votes that may appear to be against the will of my constituents, but were cast with information that made a difference in my votes for the better of either the city of Midland or the citizens of Midland. With pride, I have heard many people state that John Love always does the right thing. I had the privilege of meeting one-on-one with all the candidates for the upcoming District 2 election to replace me. John Norman is a mature candidate who keeps his word and has an immense amount of integrity. He is dedicated to this community and is interested in opportunity for all Midlanders, not just some. Norman has a proven love for this community through the work that he does with the youth of Midland. We don't need a candidate who takes direction from others behind the scenes or who may not be interested in representing all the people of District 2 and Midland. I couldn't imagine a better replacement for me as District 2 City Council member other than John Norman. I will be casting my early vote for Mr. Norman, and I urge you to do the same. He'll do the right thing. County is taking care of its own with donation to Animal Shelter, by Tracy Gerhart, president of the Midland Animal Shelter Adoptables. The Midland County Commissioner's Court will consider Monday the allocation of funds to help sponsor the building of the new Midland City Animal Shelter. I appreciate the commissioners for acknowledging the shelter does accommodate the county animals. The shelter not only accepts all county stray animals brought to them, but it also accepts many owner-surrendered animals, along with multitudes of litters. They also take in and quarantine, a minimum of 10 days, the bite cases from the county. Shelter staff assists all animal-related arrest cases that occur in the county, assists on aggressive and injured animals, processes rabies specimens for testing, as well as deceased animal disposal. And of course, the shelter takes care of all the vaccinations administered to the animal at the time of intake, as well as spay or neuter at the time of adoption. The city does all this as a courtesy for the county animals and at no cost to the county. It is wonderful to see the community come together and want to provide the animals a shelter which will provide a safe and healthy environment. The new shelter will provide for the current needs of all the animals and continue to serve in the best interest of all the animals. Approximately 15% of the animals brought into the shelter are reportedly from the county. I can say with confidence this number is quite higher. County residents don't often tell the truth when bringing in an animal because they fear the animal will be immediately euthanized. This belief is not accurate. County animals are given the same adoption or rescue opportunity as any animal, whether stray or owner surrendered. It should be noted that 15% of the cost for the new shelter is $1.26 million. It is my understanding the consideration to be donated is $1 million. I truly appreciate this consideration as acknowledgement for all the city shelter does for the county animals and its residents. Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, January 12, 2020, Section F, Oil Report. Path to Profits. New study offers 5 levers to improve service company profits, by Mella McEwen. Oilfield service firms were hard hit when oil prices cratered in late 2014, and many continue to struggle as oil prices range between $50 and $60 a barrel and operators reduce activity levels. One issue is that those companies continue to rely on a business model built on $100 oil prices, according to a study issued by Deloitte. In Down But Not Out, Transforming Oil Field Services, the consulting and advisory firm offered what it called 5 levers to improve performance. Doing so could mean an additional $20 billion in earnings for the 70 service companies Deloitte analyzed for the study, and potentially in excess of $30 billion more in earnings across the entire sector. First, Deloitte said service companies should realistically assess whether it still makes sense to service their markets in the same capacity as when oil was $100 a barrel, or whether to consolidate operations, divest assets, or exit service lines altogether. Secondly, service companies should base their services on customer behavior, creating a bundle of services with a pricing structure that is flexible enough to offer a sustainable margin, and leading service providers should go to a more structured and sophisticated approach to pricing. Service companies can raise revenue and cut costs by reviewing their operating models and redeploying assets more effectively, the firm said. The fundamental ability to conduct business planning should be improved, allowing each part of the company to adjust their capabilities to meet demand according to that plan, even if it often changes. The fifth lever service companies can use is to rethink how they deliver services and equipment with technology, not offering data just as a service solution, but using data to enhance existing capabilities, Deloitte said. Digitalization can let service companies not only move faster, but connect equipment technologies together to improve delivery at lower costs. Sean Maxson, principal and oil field services practice lead at Deloitte, discussed in an email the study and how service companies are reacting to its recommendations. Question: how receptive do you think service firms would be to these strategies? Answer: we are already seeing service firms announce more aggressive actions to optimize their portfolios and align their operating models with the new market normal. For example, shifting to more basin-specific offerings and operating models to optimize returns on capital. The next step is to invest in new technologies, capabilities, and business models that will help operators enhance recovery, boost productivity, and reduce carbon emissions. For example, we are seeing oil field service companies invest in next-generation sensor and digital technologies to enable operators to optimize production and more efficiently respond to pump failures by leveraging advanced supply chain solutions. Question: what services do you see E&P companies demanding that service companies should focus on? Answer: E&P companies are clearly demanding that service companies provide cost-effective solutions that enable them to improve returns on capital. They are also looking for the service companies to invest in differentiated technology solutions and capabilities that will enable the next level of productivity and reduce carbon emissions. Question: we see the E&P sector working to implement cash discipline, generate cash flow, and return excess cash flow to shareholders. Do you see service companies experiencing similar restraints? Answer: the services sector is experiencing the same restraints and challenges as the broader E&P sector. Investors are focused on margins, capital returns, and free cash flow. Question: how long do you think it would take for these recommended strategies to take effect, and how would they affect both the service and E&P sectors? Answer: we are already seeing oil field service companies take much more aggressive actions to optimize their portfolios and streamline their operations to improve service delivery efficiency and returns. This will benefit both the service and E&P companies by creating increased service efficiency and a more sustainable industry structure. It will also benefit both the service and E&P companies by providing the industry with more capital to invest in the technologies and capabilities needed to drive the next level of productivity. The challenge for the industry is going to be finding a new equilibrium that provides sustainable financial returns across the value chain. PBPA to honor Dick Salisbury as Top Hand by Mella McEwen. The Permian Basin Petroleum Association, PBPA, will bestow its 40th Top Hand Award on Odessan Dick Salisbury, founder of Salisbury Industries. The award will be presented at a banquet Thursday at the Petroleum Club. We are honored to be able to present Dick Salisbury the 2019 PBPA Top Hand Award this year, Ben Shepard, PBPA president, said via email. From humble beginnings, Dick has created a fantastic business employing thousands of Permian Basin folks over the last 50 years. His contributions to Odessa and the rest of the basin have been enormous. He represents all of the top qualities of a PBPA top hand. Salisbury said he's honored to receive the award. "The greatest thing is to be a top hand, whether you're called that or not," he said in a phone interview. The Smackover, Arkansas native arrived in West Texas in 1962. He first went to Wickett to work at Dixie Electric. "I assumed I'd be here 3 or 4 years and then go back to Arkansas. I've been here close to 60 years," he said. He went on to found Salisbury Electric, then added Salcon Construction Company, Eagle Instrumentation to provide pneumatic services, and then Salisbury Engineering and Construction. He consolidated the companies into Salisbury Industries, which now employs more than 5,000 people. "I didn't think it would grow like that," he said. "I didn't set a goal. My goal was doing the best I could." He said he has tried to ensure he and his employees work with integrity and try to be the best they can at what they're doing. It's more about the work, the people, the families who work for you. It's important to make a profit because without a profit, you don't have a business. But if you do good work and the people enjoy what they're doing, then you have a profit, he said. And he tries to ensure he gives back the blessings he has received, whether it's locally, statewide, or globally. You need to have a giving heart to be a top hand. If you're not willing to give, if you only want to take, you're not a top hand, he said. But above all, Salisbury said, he remembers where his blessings come from. Everything we've got comes from the Lord. He gives us talent. He opens doors for us, Salisbury said. Oilfield Labs debuts expansion that doubles Midland footprint, by Mella McEwen. Oilfield Labs of America is preparing to debut its expanded Midland operations that will double the company's local footprint. Our company opened its doors 4.5 years ago, and we never anticipated the opportunities available to us, not just in the Permian Basin, but in several regions. Amanda North, the Houston-based firm's director of lab operations, said in a phone interview. We're excited about the chance to expand our Midland facility, double its capacity, and make a little more of a mark in the Permian Basin with our customers, she added, saying the expansion is expected to open Wednesday. The expansion involves not only expanding its existing building, but adding a second building, giving Oilfield Labs an additional 4,000 square feet of lab space, bringing the company's lab space in Midland to more than 9,000 square feet, and 800 square feet of office and administrative space, including a break room. We are a commercial laboratory, a third-party, unbiased lab, said North. Our goal is to deliver high-quality data at a reasonable price. We serve the oil and gas industry, analyzing water, oil, anything that comes from the ground. The biggest demand the company is seeing is from operators who want to do more testing and analytics at their well sites, she said. The company has field teams that go out to the sites to conduct on-site testing, and the lab at 3302 Pilot Avenue is equipped to conduct high-end, very sensitive analytics, she said. Everything goes back to the data, and with the demand for evidence behind every reason why action is taken, it's more important than it has been. There's still a lot to learn, but I believe the industry is learning and growing, North said. We're fortunate to be at the forefront of the industry. The projects we're involved in require deeper dives into the data and the testing methods used. With the state-of-the-art equipment in our labs, we're at more of an advantage. There's always something to be learned, and we're happy to learn. Not only will the expansion provide more space for current testing and operations, but it will allow the company to integrate more services into its program this year, she said. Space is always a big factor when you're working in close quarters. With the demand for more of what we currently offer, plus bringing in new methods and testing equipment, expansion was necessary. That expansion includes the company's workforce, which Oilfield Labs expects to increase this year. We will be looking for driven professionals looking for a career outside the traditional oil field, North said. We value integrity above all else, and there are some amazing people in the Permian Basin we've been fortunate to scoop up. We're also looking for technical expertise. In addition to the Midland location, the company has full-service labs in Oklahoma City and Cheyenne, Wyoming.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Sunday, January 12th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Midlanders must plan their way into the future. This is a commentary article written by Patrick Payton, Midland's mayor-elect. When my family and I moved to Midland in 1999, the future did not look so bright. Fast forward 2 short decades, and we are right in the middle of historic opportunity and all the challenges that come with it. In this challenging and exciting season, I am humbled, honored, and thankful to have earned the opportunity to serve you as mayor. As we anticipate our future, allow me to reflect on what I have observed to be a few of our governing core community values, as well as share with you a few objectives for the early part of the new year. When I reflect on our city, three common West Texas values seem to always come to mind. First, I think of our love for God that informs and drives our love for one another. Second, I think of our heroic practice of bearing one another's burdens. And finally, I think of how our love for God and others, combined with sharing one another's burdens, sets a solid foundation for our third value of always trying new things, experimenting with new ideas, and taking risks that result in great gain for our city, state, and country. These solid West Texas values give me great confidence in the face of whatever challenges and opportunities we must address, regardless of economic cycle. We face many opportunities throughout our city, county, and region. Whether the issue is healthcare, education, roads, housing, public safety, or workforce development, our growth and worldwide influence have put before us opportunity that few in the state or country have ever dealt with at such magnitude and necessary speed. The new and increasing day-to-day pressures on all of us are immense. But in the midst of these day-to-day pressures, we must always stand on our most enduring values as we move forward into our most challenging times, meeting our needs, and more importantly, building on historical legacy for generations to come. As I stated throughout the campaign, if we can live by our values, we can arrive at a prioritized plan, whereby together we can move toward our brightest future. So allow me to mention a couple of key priorities as we begin this new year together. It might be an old saying, but it is still true. You can't get where you are going unless you know where you are going. Because of my firm belief in long-term, visionary planning, I have already begun the process of working with our highly qualified, ready, and willing city staff to develop a thorough and detailed long-term plan that can guide our work, and most importantly, guide our accountable and transparent expenditures of your hard-earned tax dollars. When I say a plan, I do not mean wish lists and wants based on location, interest group, political pressure, or posturing. I have been very clear about the necessity of a detailed, step-by-step, project-by-project plan of what we must accomplish as a city in order to get where we must go in our best future together. With a disciplined plan, you should expect clarity on necessary spending toward the priorities of roads, infrastructure, and safety. Sticking to a prioritized plan for our future will free up resources as well as streamline processes for all involved as we move forward. It bears repeating that if we plan and prioritize for a collective future, then no one person or segment will get exactly what they want all the time, but all of us can move toward getting what we need for a better citywide future. Additionally, I am looking forward to the continued progress the City of Midland and our other taxing entities will make as we address our current and collective challenges. There has been progress in dialogue between taxing entities, but we are entering a time when dialogue must lead to bold and creative solutions for the greater good of our city and region. Arriving at creative, collaborative, and expansive solutions that address prioritized issues with your hard-earned sales and property tax dollars can be a good start, but only a start. As we move forward, there is challenging and historical work the city, county, hospital, college, and independent school districts can do together to assist our entire region in moving toward broader solutions for every stakeholder, you the taxpayer. I am hopeful that together all taxing entities can continue to push toward solutions that move us forward as a city and region and not simply as individual entities. Remember, we can arrive at what everyone needs, though for a season, each one of us will not get all he or she wants. Make no mistake about it, we will not advance on our destiny as the host city and region of the energy renaissance without new ways of thinking, partnering, planning, and doing. We must think outside of the proverbial box and approach our unique challenges with bold new ideas in partnering between taxing entities, our neighbor Odessa, and even the region. We must be willing to look beyond what we were and what we have done as we grow into our leadership role as the critical producer of food, fuel, and fiber for the state, the nation, and even the world. We might well be served to recall that to whom much is given, much is required. The challenge and opportunity before us are indeed historical. As our oil and gas industry experiences adjustment and maturity, we as a city and region must lead the way in prioritized, methodical, and patient progress that prepares us for decades to come. Whether the issue is education, healthcare, or a neighborhood road, together, with a commitment to prioritize progress, we will emerge as one of the greatest cities in Texas and the nation. It will take time and patience, but those who come after us will be thankful that a generation of Midlanders had a vision and plan setting forth a values-driven, fiscally conservative, transparent, prioritized path for becoming the city and region that is the envy of the state, the country, and the world. This article is entitled, City Council, Members to Decide Fate of Hillcrest Village. Officials expect heavy opposition regarding a West Midland apartment complex being built to provide less expensive housing for taxing entity employees. By Stuart Doreen. The new Midland City Council on Tuesday will determine the fate of a 200-unit development expected to provide affordable housing for employees of Midland ISD and Midland Memorial Hospital and first responders. Hillcrest Village is a proposed multifamily development located on nearly 20 acres on Midland Drive, just west of Doug Russell Pool. The applicant, the Midland Community Development Corporation, is requesting a rezone of the property to a low-density apartment complex. City documents show the proposed site plan calls for 20 two-story buildings, a clubhouse, and dog park. The city also reports that adequate parking is provided with a total of 488 spaces, 246 surface spaces, and 242 garage spaces. 60% of the units would be one-bedroom, 30% would be two-bedroom, and the rest three-bedroom, officials said previously. The city's Planning and Zoning Commission approved the rezoning request during a November meeting, but some Midlanders are not in favor of the addition to West Midland. City documents show staff has received 100 written objection letters as of January 8th. 30.9% of those objecting within the 200-foot notification area. Staff also received a petition. The petition, dated October 9th, was to the Planning and Zoning Commission, the mayor, and the rest of Midland City Council. Homeowners and residents of the Hillcrest Acres, Alamo Heights, Bel Air, Westcliff, and Westgate subdivisions stated 17 reasons for their opposition. These include: residents favor single-family homes in that area. There are no city water lines and no nearby sewer lines. All houses between Princeton and Cuthbert Avenues on the north and south between Midland Drive and almost to Woodcrest Drive on the east and west are on water wells and septic systems. The neighborhood is not economically depressed and does not fit the mission statement of the Midland Community Development Corporation. These apartments would be tax-exempt because the MCDC retains ownership. Traffic will be increased and safety will be decreased in the neighborhood. The petition also states that some residents near the proposed development have lived there since the 1960s and that all but one home in the block of Princeton Avenue between Midland Drive and Woodcrest Drive are occupied by the property owner. City officials expect a full house for the council meeting. If a previous presentation in front of the Midland Development Corporation is any indication, city leaders will hear that the Hillcrest Village lease rates for a single bedroom is expected to be 30 to 50% less than current rates at other Class A properties. Project officials said at the Commission's October meeting that already there are non-binding agreements for as many as 120 total units with Midland Memorial and MISD. Hillcrest Village carries a total development cost of $41.7 million. Project officials said during the October meeting that much of that money will come from banks, but an estimated equity of $14 million is needed to keep rents lower. Project officials also said they would be asking for additional money from the MDC. Meeting notes. The Midland City Council typically meets on the second and fourth Tuesdays of the month. Tuesday's meeting will begin at 10 a.m. This will be the first meeting of the new City Council, which includes Mayor-elect Patrick Payton. Also expected to attend their first meetings are Jack Ladd Jr. of District 3 and Lori Blong of District 4. All three were elected in November. Other members of the council will be current District 1 Representative Scott Dufford, District 2 Representative John B. Love III, and at-large representatives Spencer Robnett and Michael Trost. This article is entitled Parsley CEO, 2020 Year of Stabilization. Industry has built a business model that will demonstrate unconventional shales can deliver cash flow. By Mella McEwen. A new year means a new energy industry, according to Matt Gallagher, President and Chief Executive Officer of Parsley Energy. 2019 was a year of transition. 2020 will be a year of stabilization, he told the Reporter Telegram in an interview discussing Parsley's just-completed acquisition of Jagged Peak Energy. Parsley and others discovered a resource in the Permian Basin or re-energized a resource over the past decade, and investors have not seen that benefit, he said. Now is the time to generate cash flow and give back capital and return on capital to the investors. He said he believes the unconventional shales that have put a spotlight on the Permian Basin will begin to deliver in 2020 because unconventional shale operators have moved on from growth mode to stabilization and building a business model that is not reactive to oil price fluctuations. I'm optimistic we can demonstrate what the business of unconventional shales can deliver, that we can deliver free cash flow, Gallagher said. Jagged Peak, whose acquisition was announced just 90 days ago, is a natural fit for the company because its Delaware Basin assets are in the same zip code, the same neighborhood. It lets us do more of the same at a lower unit cost, he said. The 90-day time frame from the time the deal was announced until last week's completion brought urgency with the legal side of closing the acquisition. Combining our processes and procedures will be done within 60 days, Gallagher said. It's incumbent upon us in 2020 to deliver a unified company. A majority of Jagged Peak's Delaware Basin acreage directly offset Parsley's legacy position, and the combination will give Parsley approximately 140,000 net acres in the Midland Basin and a highly contiguous 120,000 net acres in the Delaware. Gallagher said activity levels will be two-thirds Midland Basin, one-third Delaware Basin. When we combine the two companies, we'll do less and generate more cash flow. We will have more cash flow and stable growth, he said. It's anticipated the deal will generate general and administrative cost savings of $25 million in the first year and $40 to $50 million annually thereafter. The Permian Basin is already among the lowest cost, if not the lowest cost basin to operate in, and continued technical advances and efficiency gains should continue that trend, Gallagher said. Those gains and the ability to improve supply chains, hire and train staff properly should benefit both operators and service companies, he said. When he announced the deal in mid-October, Gallagher said it was the beginning of consolidation in the industry. He said last Friday that he still believes this. With our acquisition and WPX's acquisition of Felix Energy, you're seeing the playbook. Synergies, a nearby fit, accretive cash flow, he said. And with the recent relative run-up in oil prices, 2020 will have accelerated merger and acquisition activity, he said. This article is entitled Bureau of Labor Statistics, Midland's Jobless Rate Tied for 15th Lowest in November, from Staff Reports. Midland was one of 23 metropolitan areas in the nation with an unemployment rate of 2.1% or less during the month of November, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Midland's jobless rate was tied for 15th, according to the BLS. In October, a 2.1% unemployment rate tied Midland for 24th. The move to 15th stopped a slide for the Midland MSA. The BLS had reported Midland's ranking was 9th in August and 16th in September. Logan, Utah posted the lowest rate in the nation at 1.5%, Ames, Iowa 1.6%, and Provo, Orem, Utah 1.7% rounded out the top three. Logan was one of five MSAs in Utah with jobless rates at or below 2.1%. South Carolina also had five MSAs among the lowest 23 jobless rates. The Bureau of Labor Statistics also reported unemployment rates were lower in November than a year earlier in 223 of the 389 metropolitan areas, higher in 137 areas, and unchanged in 29 areas. Also, a total of 153 areas had jobless rates of less than 3%, and two areas had rates of at least 10%. The national unemployment rate in November was 3.3%, not seasonally adjusted, little change from a year earlier. The number of people in the civilian labor force inside the MSA grew from 107,736 in November 2018 to 108,457 in November 2019, according to BLS statistics. In Odessa, the number of people in the civilian labor force increased from 86,910 in November 2018 to 87,863 in November 2019, according to BLS statistics. The jobless rate in Odessa in November was 2.9%. The lowest unemployment rates in the nation during the month of November: Logan, Utah 1.5%, Ames, Iowa 1.6%, Provo, Orem, Utah 1.7%, Iowa City, Iowa 1.8%, Charleston, South Carolina 1.8%, Ogden, Clearfield, Utah 1.8%, Burlington, Vermont 1.8%, Hilton Head, Beaufort, South Carolina 1.9%, Fargo, North Dakota 1.9%, Salt Lake City, Utah 1.9%, Mankato, Minnesota 2.0%, Spartanburg, South Carolina 2.0%, Greenville, Anderson, Malden, South Carolina 2.0, Columbia, South Carolina 2.0, Midland 2.1, Boston, Cambridge, Nashua, Florida 2.1, Huntsville, Alabama 2.1, Boulder, Colorado 2.1, Fort Collins, Colorado 2.1, Gainesville, Georgia 2.1, Dover, Durham, New Hampshire 2.1, Portsmouth, New Hampshire 2.1, St. George, Utah 2.1. This article is entitled Railroad Commission, 8 of Top 10 Oil Producing Counties Are in Permian, by Stuart Doreen. 8 of the top 10 oil producing counties in October were located in the Permian Basin, according to statistics released by the Railroad Commission of Texas. Midland and Martin were again numbers 1 and 2, with the neighboring counties accounting for 21,795 million barrels, or 21.4% of the statewide total of 101.675 million barrels. That was an increase from September, when the two counties combined for 20.092 million barrels. Joining Midland and Martin were Reeves, 3rd, Howard, 5th, Upton, 6th, Loving, 7th, Ward, 9th, and Reagan, 10th. Ward cracked the list of top 10 counties statewide for the first time in recent memory. Combined, the eight Permian counties accounted for 51.261 million barrels during the month of October. That was 50.4% of the state production reported. In September, the seven Permian counties in the top 10 accounted for 44.84% of the preliminary production. Midland again ranked third for gas produced, with 35.574 million MCF produced during the month. The Railroad Commission showed Reeves topped all counties with 62,435 MCF. Midland trailed Webb County for second by less than 1 million MCF. The RRC reported 665.716 million MCF of gas was produced during the entire month. In October 2018, the preliminary number was 601.079 million MCF. The updated total was 808.648 million MCF. In October 2018, the preliminary production of crude oil was 89.719 million barrels. The updated total was 123.797 million barrels. This article is entitled "Nonprofit to Host Workshops for Mass Shooting Survivors" by Caitlin Randall. A nonprofit will host a series of workshops aimed at helping mass shooting survivors and parents of victims heal from their traumas. The first workshop, Triumph Over Tragedy, is scheduled for March. Laura Huffless, board member of the OnSite Foundation, described the workshop as a six-day healing retreat with top-of-the-line trauma therapists and clinicians. It will take place at the OnSite campus in Cumberland Furnace, Tennessee, an hour outside of Nashville. "It's really a beautiful, peaceful place, which is a perfect center for healing and community," Huffless said. 60 survivors will be accepted to participate in the first workshop. The main criteria for applicants are they must be a survivor of a mass shooting, be a year out from the shooting event, and be over 18 years of age, Huffless said. Additional admission criteria are at least 15 days of sobriety before the program begins, no smoking while on campus. Prescriptions will be evaluated on a case-by-case basis by the clinician staff. No current suicidal plan or attempt. Past attempt plans must be at least 6 months ago. No self-harm, no homicidal ideation, plans, or attempts. Although survivors of the Midland and Odessa shootings are not eligible for the first workshop because it occurred 5 months ago, Huffless encouraged survivors to apply to be considered for future workshops. "We will be doing more workshops," she said. "If we see there's a need, we can roll out more over the course of a year. And if they've applied, then they'll be the first to be in line for those workshops." The therapy each participant receives will be decided on a case-by-case basis, Huffless said. Crystal Miller, a survivor of the Columbine shooting and chair of OnSite's Survivor Advisory Council, said the program is specialized to each individual. "We recognize that trauma is so diversely different in every single person's life and in their journey," she said. "Each program is specifically curated and designed to meet each survivor exactly where they are." Miller said the program was the brainchild of Austin Eubanks, a friend and also a survivor of the Columbine shooting. Eubanks died from drug addiction 7 months ago. His dream and his vision was to see a safe refuge where survivors could go to work through their trauma and their emotional pain, Miller said. OnSite will be hosting a workshop in April titled Life After Loss for parents who have lost children to mass shootings, gun violence, suicide, illness, or other tragedies. Huffless said they will also be hosting a workshop in the fall for first responders and veterans. The cost of attending the workshops, including room and board, food and costs associated with receiving therapy, are covered by OnSite. Attendees are responsible for airfare to Nashville. OnSite will transport them from the airport. Miller said an essential component of the workshops is the fostering of community among survivors of mass shootings. "I think so often it feels like to a survivor that they are completely alone, isolated. Nobody understands, nobody can relate," she said. "Unfortunately, the group of survivors who can relate is ever growing as shootings have become so commonplace. Applications for Triumph Over Tragedy open January 6th and will close February 6th. More information about the program and how to apply can be found at theonsitefoundation.org. This article is entitled Council to Look at Zoning for Field's Edge Project, from Staff Reports. The Midland City Council will have the opportunity Tuesday to approve a zone change needed on the 23.66 acres of land in southwest Midland for a tiny home community for the chronically homeless. The Field's Edge organization is hoping for a zone change from agricultural estates to planned development that will allow for a housing development less than a quarter of a mile south of Interstate 20 and less than half a mile west of South County Road 1235. The community is expected to provide permanent homes to about 100 homeless residents of the Permian Basin. A site plan shows 10 pods of 8 to 10 tiny homes, according to city documents. Each pod includes a bath, kitchen, laundry facility, and a missional home. The proposed density is 4.2 units per acre. A site plan also shows a hospitality building, two chapels, a market, a health building, a pavilion, a playground, a workshop, a physical activity center, a garden, a maintenance area, and storage facility. According to the website for the Field's Edge, the gifts and talents of our residents will be developed into micro-enterprises, enabling them to earn a dignified income. Partnerships are being forged with mental and physical health care providers to give residents the care they need. The Field's Edge will be a permanent place to call home, a place for neighbors to walk alongside each other for life. The Planning and Zoning Commission has recommended the request for approval, and the city staff had not received any letters of objection as of January 8th, according to the city. The council will meet at 10 a.m. Tuesday in City Council Chambers inside City Hall, 300 North Lorraine Avenue. This article is entitled Far West Texas Ranch is Priced at $320 Million, by Steve Brown, Dallas Morning News. A West Texas ranch that's as big as Texas is up for grabs with a price tag to match. The Brewster Ranches sprawl over 420,000 acres on the north side of Big Bend National Park. Bigger than Dallas County, the rugged property stretches from the banks of the Rio Grande River to the town of Marathon, and includes everything from canyons to deserts and mountains. The property includes more than 500-foot-high peaks, deep ravines, and running waterways. It's the largest property for sale in Texas and one of the biggest spreads offered in all of North America. Kentucky businessman Brad Kelly, who's one of the biggest landowners in the U.S., assembled the mammoth Trans-Pecos tract and is offering it for sale for, get ready for it, $320 million. Kelly acquired the Brewster Ranches over several decades and has now decided to sell, Fort Davis real estate broker James King told Marfa Public Radio. King Land and Water is marketing the ranch for sale in one piece or in separate parcels. We would love to find an owner who would keep the resources intact, King said in a Marfa radio interview. The Brewster Ranches include multiple buildings and houses, including a 5-bedroom, 4-bath Spanish hacienda built around a central courtyard. There is also an airstrip and hangar. The Brewster Ranches is by far the largest of several big properties in far west Texas that have hit the market within the last couple of years. It's in the same area of the state as the 70,000-acre Lely Ranch near the Big Bend State Park that has been for sale since 2018. Dallas-based Icon Global Group is marketing the Lely Ranch. Last year, an El Paso businessman paid $32.5 million for the 37,000-acre KC7 Ranch in the foothills of the Davis Mountain in Reeves and Jeff Davis counties. Icon Global Group handled that sale, too. This article is distributed by Tribune Content Agency.
That's the end of the first hour of the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American. We'll begin our second hour right after we take a look at weather.